Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Matt Chappelle. Matt's an investor with Frist Cressy Ventures. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Christian, good to be here. I appreciate you having me and look forward to the discussion.
Yeah, well, I have to start off by giving you some much due recognition. So this is a week where we're recognizing the NVCA award winners and rising stars, and congratulations. Really excited to have you on. For really good reason, and it's great to see our industry recognize you.
Well, I appreciate it. I was grateful for the award and grateful to the NVCA and the work that they do for the venture community at large. So just grateful to be able to attend the event and be considered for one of the awards. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, our audience is really fortunate because now we're going to get an insider scoop here as to what excellence looks like. And so with that, let's start with Frist Cressy. What's the firm's investment thesis and what's your role?
Yeah, well, I always like to start, if you go back to the founding story, because I always think it's important and it's helpful. It gives you a sense of our DNA and kind of who we are today. But the firm itself founded about 8 or 9 years ago. The two founders, they're the names on the door, but Senator Bill Frist and Brian Cressy. Senator Frist is former Senate Majority Leader. He's a thoracic surgeon by training and comes from a family of healthcare providers who started a large health system. And then Brian Cressy has been a lifelong private equity investor focused mostly on healthcare. He started three very successful private equity funds. And and ultimately about 9 years ago, the two of them got together and they basically said, okay, look, we've experienced healthcare our entire lives, and it's given us our entire professional careers. What is the best and fastest way that we can make an impact on the industry? And as they started to do the work and do some research, what they found was a lot of the early stage businesses that were entrepreneurial backed, innovative, utilizing technology in different ways, those were the organizations and the companies that were actually changing the trajectory of healthcare. And you know, they basically said, look, if those are the companies changing healthcare, why don't we create a venture fund? We'll partner with them. If we do it well, we'll theoretically change healthcare forever, and that can be our legacy. So that was the genesis of the fund 8 years ago. We are currently on our fourth fund. Once we close this fund, we'll be north of $1 billion in AUM. That's exactly what we do, is we focus entirely on the healthcare ecosystem and those that are changing the industry. We obviously have to have financial returns for our LP base, and it's something that we obviously prioritize. However, we believe that if you put the patient first, then you put improving their life first, that the decision of whether you should make an investment or not, the financial returns will follow. So very practically, we write $5 to $15 million checks in seed and Series A stage businesses, healthcare technology, healthcare services. The things we don't do is anything that requires FDA approval. So think med device, life sciences, biotech, those kinds of things. Hopefully that gives you a sense, but I do think one of the core tenets of our fund and FCV at large is that real mission alignment to transforming an industry that I think impacts everybody.
And your role?
I'm an investor on the team here, so principal on the investment team. We've got 17 individuals, 14 of which are here in Nashville. We've got two up in New York, and then we've got one in Chicago, but principal on the investment team.
Okay, fantastic. So for the benefit of our audience who are not as familiar with the healthcare industry, I'll paint a very broad brush, generally conservative. Maybe historically not as fast to adopt technology, given dependencies on frontline physician workers who may be overworked or have burnout from their EMR. Heavy now emphasis on demonstrating patient outcomes.
as the world transitions to performance from a fee-based model. And so, you know, that's my, you know, my 100,000 foot perspective. Would love to hear how you think about it, the firm thinks about it. And then from there, if we can start segueing in and how you start looking at potential portfolio companies and the problems that you prefer to see they solve, they're solving.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think at a high level, I guess first, your kind of take on the healthcare industry, I think, is spot on. At a high level, how we think about it is the reality is we have to do more with our healthcare ecosystem. We have to drive innovation. If we don't, I don't know that it's going to be a great outcome. You've got, you know, anywhere from 18 to 20% of GDP going to healthcare, and it's anticipated to continue to rise. Rising costs, poor quality and outcomes. In some cases, we are one of the worst countries in the U.S. And so, and then simultaneously, you've got workforce challenges that require both payers and providers and health systems to have to do more with less. They have fewer people, fewer resources, financially constrained. And so we are at a unique point within the healthcare ecosystem where we're almost at a breaking point, where if we don't start to drive meaningful change, and a lot of that, from our perspective, looks like innovation and maybe adoption of technology and unique payment models like you referenced. If we don't start to do that as an industry, you know, we could be in some really dire straits here in a handful of years. And so what that looks like for us is you know, trying to identify and drive investments in companies that are addressing some of the biggest pain points in the industry. Workforce, adoption of technology, this concept of interoperability, higher quality care, value-based care, you know, payment for performance as opposed to fee-for-service. These are some of the areas and the things that I think, you know, if we spend our time in the appropriate places and there's companies being built in those areas, I do think we're going to start to see some innovation happening in the healthcare landscape. I think you can't help but talk about, you know, AI in today's world. And the reality is it's going to drastically and radically transform healthcare. The amount of untapped data that is available for AI and applications, the amount of manual labor in a health system. I saw a statistic that 75% of healthcare is still delivered via fax machine. And so there are some pretty tremendous opportunities when you think about the adoption of technology in the industry. And it's really about how do you navigate that change and the change management and stitching together a historically challenging and broken system and stitch it all together to ride the tailwinds of the technology coming out.
So it sounds like we have consensus that there's a lot of structural issues. And you know, my experience has been when you're talking about an industry that's a fifth of GDP, you know, structural changes, like, they don't turn on a dime. It's more like an aircraft carrier, you know, big wide. But at the same time, you know, if you look at seed and series A size companies, they all have in common is they need to make sales. You can only raise so many rounds, i.e. you need cash flow. So how do you think about, you know, as you're doing due diligence on a founder and their solutions, like, where's the sweet spot between getting enough traction within the industry to confirm that the founder's problem they're solving is accurate, but at the same time knowing that, you know, if we want to make inroads into health systems or payers, you know, that sales cycle is a whole lot longer than what most founders would prefer.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think it's something we, you know, we've kind of joked or talked about as a fund that, you know, healthcare. I'm sure other industries have it as well, but it feels like it's a great example of what we call kind of like tourist investors, right? It's like, and you could see this in COVID, right? Everybody said, oh my goodness, we've got to go to virtual solutions. There's going to be a boom in healthcare here. Let's run to investing in the space. And you had a lot of folks who were smart in healthcare, but maybe were not, you know, in it every single day, that flooded the market, flooded the space and made a ton of investments. And Some have been tremendously successful, others maybe not so much, and you know, a lot of the verdict is still out. But what you're touching on, I think, has historically been kind of one of the challenges for these quote unquote tourist investors. And that is, you have folks that look at the industry and say, I don't understand why it's so hard. Let's just go drive innovation and push technology and it'll be successful. And what you realize is sales cycles are, you know, we're high-fiving if you get a 12-month sales cycle. Everything else is, you know, usually 12 to 18 months before you get a decision maker to sign off and say, you know, let's move forward. And that's something that I think, you know, you have to know when you start to look at these businesses as an investor. You have to recognize that this is going to take time. You're going to need to appropriately capitalize the business to push through a pipeline so that you can make enough meaningful progress before you raise the next round. So I think first you have to just start with the awareness of that to say, you know, is this appropriately capitalized? Are we right-sizing the business here from a capital formation perspective? The second thing, though, that I do think we as a venture fund, and there are other healthcare funds that do this as well, but you know, one of our biggest value props is trying to shorten that sales cycle. So 30 to 40% of our capital, our LP base, are payers and providers. So think national health systems, national payers. And part of the value prop that we'd say to these entrepreneurs is, you know, hopefully we might be able to help you navigate the ecosystem to turn an 18-month sales cycle into a 12-month sales cycle. And that is the you know, one of the core, we have a couple, but one of the core reasons and ways in which we try to add value. But you're spot on. I mean, that is one of the hardest challenges with healthcare is getting it into the hands of the actual end purchaser in a timely fashion.
Well, I think it's brilliant. You know, I know a lot of VCs seek to answer the question, what is their platform going to look like? And what I consistently hear is network, network, network is number one on the list of what's most valuable to founders. So I think that makes great sense. And especially in an industry like healthcare, you know, if you can have someone on your cap table that can you know, minimize the amount of time to get ink on paper, that's brilliant. Love it.
Yeah.
If we could take a moment, I would love to pivot over to you personally, your career progression and what it looked like leading up to joining the firm.
Sure. I always kind of say I have a little bit of a unique, in some cases it's very traditional, in some cases it's very unique, but I grew up in Florida in Fort Myers, Naples area, so far down south. I grew up to a family of clinicians, my father, my mother, and my sister, all behavioral health clinicians, and my dad took a path into hospital administration from early on in his career. So I grew up in a healthcare family. I you know, had dinner table conversations with my dad about how do you run hospitals and what does that look like. I also had an affinity for the sciences, and so I like many, went to college thinking I'm going to go pre-med. Quickly found out that was not the route for me. But I went to school up in Chicago. But I knew I loved healthcare. I knew it's where I wanted to spend my career. It's the industry that I felt like impacted the most folks and provided some you know, real satisfaction to the work that you get to do on a daily basis. And so went to college in Chicago. I went to a small school up there, a liberal arts college called Wheaton College, had the chance to play baseball. And the whole time while I was in school, I thought I was going to go be a nurse. And I thought I'll go do the nursing route. I will, you know, maybe use that as a way to get into hospital administration and that'll be my path. Simultaneously was getting a business major as well. So had a little bit of the both there. Graduated college, was going to nursing school. And in between the summer of graduation and starting nursing school, I said, I think I'm using nursing school as a means to an end. I really just want to get into the business side of healthcare. Then had an opportunity to join an organization called Universal Health Services, or UHS, which is a large for-profit health system, and worked with one of their hospitals in the Chicagoland area doing business development. Realized I loved healthcare, didn't love business development, and thought my skill set more aligned on the financial side of things. parlayed that into investment banking. So then I worked for a healthcare investment bank for a handful of years in Chicago and absolutely loved my experience. But you get to a point, as many do in banking and consulting and other industries, where you start to say, what else is out there? Is this, what I want to do for my career, or are there other opportunities? Ironically, while I was in banking, we were engaged on a transaction to sell a business, and we were going through that merger process, and Frisk Cressy was one of the original investors in that company. And so I got a call one day, and I guess, I don't know, I guess the partner appreciated the models I was putting together or something. But I got a call one day after we closed that transaction by a partner, and he said, "Hey, we're expanding our team. Any interest in joining the fund?" And I just recently gotten married. This was 7 years ago. Just recently gotten married. My wife was tired of me working until 1 a.m. and eating pizza and burgers and all of those kinds of things. And we were excited for something new, and so I had a chance to join the fund here 6.5 years ago and moved to Nashville. So that's my background. It's a little bit unique, just given I didn't go to a, quote unquote target school for investment banking. I didn't go to a bulge bracket or anything like that, but I've been incredibly grateful for the opportunities that I've been able to land in and work with, and the people in which I get to do so.
Well, congrats on your success. That's awesome. And I'm willing to bet that you learn more at UHS than you could possibly do in an MBA program.
It was a great learning experience. When you have to learn healthcare and you have to learn it quickly, getting thrown into a biz, biz dev role, you learn quickly. It forces you to have to know your stuff. So it was a tremendous experience.
Well, I don't know how much of our audience may think of a health system as a black box, and or if that's an appropriate characterization, but what were some of your key lessons learned or takeaways when you were at UHS?
I think one of the ones is at the end of the day, healthcare is a hard industry because you're dealing with humans. And we obviously we try to drive technology, and we try to drive unique approaches to innovation within the overall ecosystem. But I think when you're spending every day going into a hospital, you see that it is a human-based business. It is an encounter-based business, from everything from the patient entering in, whether it's an emergency department or a pre-scheduled appointment, to seeing a clinician, the comfort of feeling an individual in the room with you name it, right? You're at the end of the day, you're in a hospitality business, and the power of the people both within the org, the power of people at UHS and those encountering the patients, but then also the power of the patients coming in. My eyes were immediately open to, oh my goodness, this is a hospitality-based business where you have to care about the people and you have to care about what it is that they're here for. That was one. The second, healthcare is complex. This was at a time where the system I worked for, UHS, we didn't have an electronic health record, which is crazy. People would think, oh my goodness, I didn't realize you worked there in the 90s, Matt, but I didn't. This was in 2011, 2015, right? That there was not, an electronic health record. So literally everybody's taking notes on pen and paper. And it was eye-opening to sit there and, kind of in a bit of a naive way, you say, I don't get it. Why? Let's just adopt technology, or let's just drive technology into this system. And you don't realize just how complicated and challenging healthcare is to move, to your point, like an aircraft carrier. So those were some of the key learnings. I guess the last thing I would say is you really see the importance of leadership. And this is the case, anywhere where you get operating experience. But the power of the leaders within an organization to drive change, instill culture, set a vision, motivate employees. I had the experience to work with tremendous leaders both at UHS and even at Ziegler, where I did my investment banking, and obviously now here at Frisk Cressy, tremendous founders and leaders here. But I do think when you're in it every day at a health system and at a hospital, you can see the power of the leaders from physicians to C-suites to nurse managers, all of those kinds of things.
So, man, a bunch to touch on. Let's start with interoperability. So, especially given Senator Frist's, role in the government, I'm curious whether or not you or the firm have an opinion to the extent that the government should be directing standards for sharing health information. And then for everyone's benefit, this is being recorded in August 2025. I want to say the current administration recently released an EO about interoperability. But I think it's just great to get your perspective is why is it taking an EO?
It's a good question. It's a challenging topic, and there's a lot of facets to it. For context, this concept of interoperability, right? I always like to say to people who don't fully understand, it basically what it's being driven off of is electronic health records don't talk to other electronic health records, and there's different instances across the health system. And so you might go to a clinic on First and Main, and your record is there, but it doesn't pass to the hospital, on Second and Main. And so those records and that data doesn't transfer. It's not interoperable. I often like to joke, it's like the equivalent of going to somebody who runs an organization and saying, "Hey, let's give Christian Gmail. Let's give Matt Outlook. Let's give, so and so Yahoo, and let's give somebody else, AOL from an email perspective, and let's see how this organization runs," right? And you might sit here and go, "Well, we don't have calendar access, so then I can't see when's Christian available. I don't know if he read my email or not. I don't know, Basically, you've created a system where the communication lacks between your employees because they're all on different instances of something." That's interoperability within healthcare. And so the challenge there is obviously with sharing of data, with kind of removing interoperability, is now you have access to hundreds of millions of patient records that are flowing in between clinics and hospitals and payers and providers. And there are reasons why you might not want that to happen. The reality is we are getting to a point, though, kind of what I was saying at the start of this call, where I think the negatives are starting to outweigh the positives are starting to outweigh the negatives of having interoperability in place. And I think the administration, who knows kind of where it'll shake out and how it'll shake out. And one of the joys and benefits of working with a former majority leader is you have some pretty interesting insights into policy. And I think one of the things he would say is, you never overreact to what you're hearing because it's always pending a change. But you start to see what some of the things that they're doing, and it starts to make sense. There needs to be interoperability within healthcare, and you've got a handful of folks who have a stronghold on the market, and which is for better or for worse, but it's creating some challenges to adopt innovation. And to my point earlier, we are at a breaking point where you have to start to remove all barriers limiting innovation and adoption of technology. And one of those is interoperability.
I heard you also mention, and I've never really heard it characterized, but as healthcare as a hospitality business, I think that's a great analogy, or parallel. And as I think about it, core to it is diagnosis, treatment, procedure. Obviously, artificial intelligence is hitting everything. And I'm sure, like myself, you've now seen stories coming out of innovation groups and different research groups of where they're suggesting that AI's ability to diagnose certain diseases is better than humans. What's the firm and your take on where the technology currently stands?
It's one we spend a lot of time thinking about, and we will continue to. We have set on our calendars every 2 weeks. We have a team meeting where we specifically talk about AI and what we're learning and what we're seeing and what we've learned over the past 2 weeks. And so the pace of change within AI and the technology, especially within healthcare, is happening so fast that you have to almost be spending all of your time there. Otherwise, you're going to be so far behind. And so that's where we have been trying to spend a meaningful amount of our time and think through questions like this. Will we have, robot doctors and robots in the health systems and hospitals treating patients? I don't know. I mean, I maybe if margins get so thin, maybe by almost you have to, but I don't see it moving in that direction because I, again, to go back to the hospitality piece, I don't know that that's necessarily what consumers fully want. However, do consumers want fast answers? Do consumers want easy answers? Do consumers want quick diagnoses? Yes. And so I do think there's going to be a world where you're going to start to see a lot of healthcare being driven by AI and technology with a human in the loop. With a provider or prescriber still involved in some capacity. We spent some time thinking about, what is primary care going to look like in 5 years? Now that you have access to LLMs and different chat features and models where you're getting the information you would typically ask your primary care doc, what does that encounter with your primary care doc look like now? Is it focused on other things? Is it used to help triage and navigate to specialties? These are the things I think we're spending a lot of time thinking about. The reality is, consumers have shown that these AI tools, LLMs, are powerful, they're helpful. We use them in our day-to-day. Agents are incredibly helpful and valuable. And so they're going to start to get into the diagnosis and delivery of care. And that's exciting for us. It's a tremendous opportunity, and it goes back to there's a strain on the industry, and anything we can do to help with that.
So any portfolio companies in fund three or two that are that you'd like to just highlight is good ex you know great current examples of the firm's outlook
Yeah.
on the industry.
Well, we don't have any favorite children.
Sure.
Although I do have two kids at home, and depending on the day, I may have an answer or not. But we don't have any favorite children, so we love them all equally. I think you can break down our portfolio into a couple categories. One is value-based care, and what that looks like is for those that might be unfamiliar, is historically healthcare has been delivered in what they call fee-for-service, which means if you come in and I look at your knee, I get to bill for that look. If I look at your elbow, I get to bill for that look. If I look at your arm, I get to bill for that look. And so you're paid based off of what you do. Value-based care is an attempt to curb costs. And what it is now is I just get paid to make sure that Christian stays healthy. And it shifts my align, it realigns my incentives as opposed to say, I need to look at his knee and his elbow and his finger and his. It shifts that to say, I just need to make sure he's healthy and stays out of the hospital. That shift is something we really, really, really love to participate in. So we've got businesses doing that in kind of the started in the chronic kidney disease and has moved now into more kind of polychronic disease management, a business called Monogram. We have some doing that in palliative care. We had a business called CareBridge, which was doing it in the Medicaid population. Oshi is in GI, Vasana's in women's health. But we've got a lot in that space, and really trying to find the different specialties of healthcare and then see if there's a value-based care model around them. The second group of companies that we spend time with is technology. And that's where a lot of the AI kind of intersection happens. We've got one doing revenue cycle management automation, business called Codemetrics. We have a recent investment in an ambient scribing business called Ambience. We've got one doing data abstraction so that you can submit claims, a business called Carta. And then the third bucket, I would say, and it's a little bit of an overlap of the two, but the third is more on like patient experience. Front door, how do you make sure you're navigating to the appropriate level of care? How do you engage with your doctor, with your health plan? And we have a handful in that space. Think of businesses like DexCare and Praya and a couple others that are addressing that. So hopefully that gives you a sense of where we spend our time, how we spend it, and how we kind of think about the market.
Yeah, I mean, I think that provides a lot of insight. And as I'm listening, I'm thinking, patient satisfaction, same as customer satisfaction. And you think about it, make a visit a hotel or, you're out your service provider, it's identical concept.
Yeah.
Time is valuable. We want to make sure that we get it right the first time if possible, and make sure they get sense.
Yeah. I think sorry, I think you're spot on. This is where I kind of say that healthcare is a hospitality business, but when you talk to hotel operators, oftentimes they'll discuss their hotel in terms of number of keys. Right? It's like, we've got this is a 400 key hotel. When you talk to hospital operators, they talk about the number of beds. And so there are these kind of unique parallels to say, okay, well, what does our experience look like from a hospitality perspective? And what does our experience look like from a healthcare perspective? And I do think there's a piece in there, while drastically different industries, drastically different payers and compensation structures and revenue models, there's some parallels there. And I think one of the big things that we need to address in the healthcare ecosystem is, this concept of an educated consumer. And in order to really become a consumer and put the choice in the consumer's hand and to create a more empowered consumer within healthcare, you first have to be educated. And I think you go back to what the airlines have done, what hotels have done, what pick the industry rental cars have done, right? Is they've taken a complex process, but they've created it to be so simple that the consumer can understand how to navigate the other side of that. I always like to say, could you imagine if you go to book your hotel or your plane ticket, and they say you could fly on a 737, a Cessna 100, 742, right? All these different plane types. You would say, I have no clue how to book a plane ticket. They've distilled it all the way down into where do you want to go and what's the time you want to leave and here's your price. And I do think that is something that we need to start to do in healthcare, to put the power in the consumer's hand to be able to make more educated decisions, to be empowered to make the right decisions. And so I throw that in there just as you kind of picked up on the theme here of like hospitality and healthcare's hospitality industry. In order to do so and to make it that way, you have to have an empowered consumer. And that's, I think, a huge opportunity for the industry.
I think that's a great lens. I often share with our team, think with the end in mind. And in this case, it's, hey, I want to be healthy.
Yeah.
And so if you can minimize the amount of variables on that road, you should result in a better experience. And so then if you can answer what are the nodes on the way, man, you got a lot of capital to deploy. It sounds like you guys are having good success for a reason. Love it. Man, I wish we had more time. But before we wrap up, there's a couple more questions. So obviously really awesome background, very unique. I can totally see why NVCA recognized you, given that you've been in the trenches. But like all things, there's always, in my experience, maybe something we would do different. Love to know, as you reflect back, if you had an opportunity to have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
It's a good question. Probably one I should spend more time, we should all spend time thinking about, what would we say to our younger self? And one of the things for me that I do kind of, I don't want to say regret, because I'm perfectly grateful and incredibly thankful for where I am, but is the nursing school piece. I do think, working within the healthcare industry, and seeing the challenges just from the outside, I do oftentimes say, man, should I have gone to nursing school just to at least have the experience to recognize and understand what it's truly like to work in the four walls of a hospital, to recognize and understand what it's truly like to be working with these challenges on a daily basis. That's one thing. Again, I don't know that I necessarily would change anything about about where I am or what I've done, but I do often think about the power of putting yourself in the industry itself to determine how it works and the pain points and all of that. So I don't know, maybe that's one, but again, it's a question that we should probably all wrestle with more so that we can learn from our previous past.
I mean, I think it's a good question. I mean, it's difficult. There's so much that needs to be done, and so many opportunities to hone our skills. But I definitely see where you're coming from. You know, being having that experience can be very valuable. I see it. Last question. You know, sounds like you're just as fortunate as myself in having had some great people in our lives to guide us along the way. Would love to give you an opportunity to give them a shout out. Anyone personally or professionally that's had a material impact on your career up to this point.
I've had a handful, and I could start first and foremost probably with my dad. He was an incredible example to me, and so obviously I could talk there. I could talk about my wife. You know, you and I touched about that briefly. An individual that I would say has probably had a meaningful impact on my life, and unfortunately passed away a couple of weeks ago, but was a professor of mine by the name of William Pollard, who he was the former CEO of an organization called ServiceMaster. For those that don't know, ServiceMaster was an incredible business that scaled tremendously fast and is still around today, but he was the CEO there. And you know, one of the things that I think he was such an interesting example for me was it felt like he had an uncanny ability to balance professional success with family, with personal, with faith, with all of these different kind of components. And that I think is a when you see folks who are able to do that, as we all know, it is very, very challenging to balance all of these things. And I think, you know, in some instances, you might say, well, you can let your professional success, you know, fall so that the others and he had an uncanny ability to say we can be successful across the board, and that seeing him and talking to him with how do you balance personal and family and faith and success and all of that, it had a lasting impact on me and will for the
Well, God bless William and
rest
shout
of my life.
out. You know, yeah, I mean, it could be hard. I think part my take is, you know, it's a I think intuitively you can see how it's a virtuous circle, but it could be difficult to measure. And also the feedback loop cycles are different. You know, it's a lot easier to see day to day with work when we're doing a great job, a little bit harder to see when you're raising the kiddos of the impact it's going to be from adolescence to teenager to when they're in their 20s. But you know, God, you know, it's great that we have people like William who can give us that that example, because I mean it's been my experience.
It was he was an amazing mentor of mine and was up until he passed away a few weeks ago.
Fantastic. Matt, really appreciate your time. If there are any members of our audience that'd like to get a hold of you or learn more about Frisk Cressy Ventures, how can they find you?
Yeah, of course. I'm always open to I'm always open to speaking with folks, those that selfishly, obviously, investor hat on, right? Those that might be raising capital. Would love to chat. Investor hat off. I love doing this. I love working with entrepreneurs. It's something that I get out of bed excited about. It's what motivates me. And so always open for conversations with folks. Best way to do so is probably via email. My wife jokes I respond to emails faster than texts. So you can email me at mchappelle@fcventures.com. Obviously, you can give me a call as well. But my email, my line's always open. Happy to connect with folks.
Fantastic. And again, Matt, thank you. Matt Chappell, investor at Frisk Cressy Ventures and recent NVCA Rising Star Award winner. Matt. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Christian. I appreciate you taking the time and having me on the show, and grateful to be here. So thank you.
My pleasure. And with that, thank you again for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.